and then fail to report the crime. Mr. Moore shrugged. They may be waiting for the right moment. You know the situation in Washington, Sarah. You said it yourself. McKinley's still looking for some way out of this damned war. Maybe they're waiting until he has no way out.
In that case, why not remove the child later? Miss Howard asked. Or sooner. There was more war hysteria in the spring than there is right now.
Perhaps they've simply mistimed their play, the doctor offered, writing Spanish War Party on the board. Spain is hardly being run by geniuses at the moment. Those who favor war are either psychopathic sadists like Weyler, by which he meant the infamous General Weyler, the Governor General of Cuba, who'd begun the practice of putting Cuban peasants into what they called concentration camps, where they couldn't help the rebels but could die like flies of disease and starvation. Or deluded monarchists, dreaming of the days of the conquistadors. The doctor stood away from the board. So, that completes the list of suspects. One of the groups hires a professional. He abducts the child, and it is taken into hiding by
the woman on the train, Miss Howard answered quickly. She's the caretaker, unless you think the senora was mistaken about seeing the baby.
A different woman might have been, the doctor answered, but this woman, no. She has the presence of mind to come here and discuss the affair in detail, even though she's aware of the potential consequences should her husband discover it. This is not a woman given to either delusions or hysteria, no. When she says she saw the child, I believe her. Inclining toward the bottom of the circle on the board, the doctor wrote, "The woman on the train." The colon showing that he intended to write more. All right, John, he continued, explain this mysterious woman in a political context. Mr. Moore looked to be at a loss. Well, she's just what Sarah says, a caretaker. She was dressed like a governess, the senora said, probably another professional hired for the job. A job which she undertakes on the last car of the Third Avenue elevated in the middle of the night? It won't do, John, and you know it. Though I'm inclined to agree with you about her being a professional of some kind. He wrote the words, governess or nurse, after the last phrase as he added, but for entirely different reasons. She could have been taking the train down to the Cubans' headquarters, Mr. Moore protested. John, Miss Howard said, fairly condescendingly, anyone who goes to the trouble of hiring a kidnapper and a nurse can certainly afford to pay for a cab. Have you ever met those Cuban revolutionary fellows, Sarah? Mr. Moore answered, topping her condescension. I have. They're a moth-eaten group if ever I saw one. Whatever money Hearst is using to spread war fever, he isn't giving much of it to them.
John's right about that much, Marcus said. Maybe they've run out of funds.
Which still does not explain what the devil she was doing on the train in the first place, the doctor answered. The general idea is to keep the child hidden, isn't it? Not parade her around before half of the city. There must be a reason why they would allow her to be seen in public, and that reason must have a political dimension.
Lucius spoke up. Well, there's really only one. The doctor turned. Yes? They wanted the girl to be seen.
Dr. Kreisler nodded once. Yes. Thank you, Detective Sergeant. That is, in fact, the only possibility. The words, deliberate display, then went up. Someone, somewhere, perhaps even the senora, was supposed to see the child, so that the kidnappers could prove they actually have her and are in earnest. And the best place to do such a thing would be in a very public place. And so we arrive at our final destination. The doctor moved up to the left-hand side of the circle. Having demonstrated that they have the child, our abductors make their demands known. Yet the senora seems to think that they have not.
Consul Baldassano and Linares could be lying to her, Lucius said. They may have received the demands and don't intend to meet them. They don't want to stink, so they lie to the mother.
The doctor was busy writing demands as he weighed this. Yes, again, Lucius, the only possibility, really, unless Moore is right, and they're biding their time. But whether they're waiting or have been refused, what is it that each group would want? A simple kidnapping for ransom is again ruled out here because one doubts that the Spanish would fail to meet mere monetary demands. We must stick to the political dimension, which means what?
Well, Mr. Moore said, the American jingoes and the Cubans want just one thing, war. It's not really a matter of demands as such.
The doctor spun around and pointed an accusing finger at his old friend, smiling.
Precisely. Thank you, Moore, for eliminating two of your own suggested culprits.
He turned round again, writing war under demands, as another lost look came over Mr. Moore's face.
What are you talking about, Chrysler? You abduct a child. Your goal is a diplomatic incident. The child's disappearance is designed to be the cause. Her absence alone is important. Beyond that, she is a liability.
Miss Howard's face lit up.
Yes. And in that case, why is the child still alive?
Exactly, Sarah, the doctor answered. For both the American war party and the Cubans, the living child is only a breathing risk. She can only contribute to their capture. If either group were responsible, the Linares girl would be at the bottom of one of our rivers by now, or perhaps, like the detective sergeant's discovery of Sunday night, in pieces at the bottom of several rivers. Of all the potential political culprits, only the Spanish would have any interest in keeping the child alive. Yet they also have the greatest interest in keeping her out of sight and the most resources with which to make sure she stays so. And thus, the doctor drew a hard line back to the top of the board, a circle leading nowhere. Time, as I say, may reveal it to be the correct analysis, but, he paused, looking at his work, then he said, Detective Sergeant, and inclined his head toward Lucius. Doctor? Have you made a copy of this diagram?
Yes, sir.
Good. Keep it in the unlikely event that we should need to refer to it again.
The doctor picked up an eraser.
What are you saying, Dr. Chrysler? Marcus asked.
I am saying, Marcus, he answered, starting to wipe away what he'd written with energetic strokes, that it is all so much poppycock.
When the doctor stepped back from the board again, only two sets of words remained. An abduction, toward the top of the board, and the woman on the train, governess or nurse, at the bottom.
Remove all the improbable details contained in the circle and we are left with a far more useful geometric configuration.
He proceeded to slowly and deliberately drag the chalk from the words at the top of the board to those at the bottom.
A straight line.
We all looked at the thing for a few seconds. It seemed like there was an awful lot of empty space on that board all of a sudden. Mr. Moore sighed, putting his feet up.
Meaning exactly what, Chrysler?
The doctor turned, his face darkened by genuine apprehension.
It's understandable that you seek to impose a political explanation on this crime, John, because the alternative is, in fact, far more disturbing and volatile. Yet it is also far more likely.
He pulled out his cigarette case and offered its contents to Miss Howard, Marcus, and Mr. Moore in turn. I was dying for a smoke myself, but it'd have to wait. After they'd all lit their sticks, the doctor took to pacing in his usual way, and he was still going when he announced,
I believe that the detective sergeant's analysis of the physical evidence is, as always, flawless. Señora Linares was in all probability attacked by another woman, whose use of a piece of pipe she found on the scene, as well as her willingness to strike in a public place in broad daylight, indicates spontaneity. That she did not injure the Signora more seriously is a testament to blind luck and the limits of her own strength, I suspect, and not to any professional skill.
All right, Mr. Moore answered, though he was clearly unconvinced.
In that case, Chrysler, I've got only one question, though it's a big one.
Why?
Indeed. The doctor walked over and wrote, Why, in large letters on the left-hand side of the board. A woman takes a child. She demands no ransom. And several days later she is observed in public apparently caring for the girl as if, the doctor seemed to be searching for the right words.
It was Miss Howard that gave them to him.
As if she were her own.
The doctor turned his gleaming black eyes on Miss Howard for a moment.
As always, gentlemen, he said, Sarah's unique perspective cuts to the heart of the matter, as if the child were her own. Think of it. Whoever this woman is, she has managed to abduct out of all the children in New York one whose disappearance could cause an international crisis. Bend your mind to it for a moment more. If there is no political dimension to the abduction, what does that tell us?
Mr. Moore scoffed. That she didn't do her damned homework, that's what it tells us.
Meaning?
It was Cyrus's turn to step in.
Meaning, if you'll excuse me, Mr. Moore, that faced with the situation she was in, she couldn't do anything but obey the impulse of the moment.
He glanced around at the others, then smiled a bit and looked to the floor.
Something I know a little about.
Precisely, Cyrus, the doctor said, starting to note things under the Y heading.
Thank you. It means that she was in the grip of an urge, a spontaneous urge that destroyed any possibility not only of self-control, but of premeditation, of researching her victim, of, as Moore rather caustically puts it, doing her homework. What could possibly cause such recklessness?
Well, I hate to state the obvious, Marcus said, but she apparently wanted a baby.
True, the doctor said with a quick nod, adding this thought to the Y column.
Then he erased the notations at the bottom of the board and moved them up to the middle right-hand side. There were now three general categories up top. Y, an abduction, and the woman on the train, governess or nurse, with space to the extreme right for one more.
But not just any baby, Lucius added quickly. Apparently she wanted this baby.
And quite desperately, Miss Howard said.
Good, the doctor pronounced. Then he scratched the Linares child in the top right-hand corner of the board. But you must all slow down. We run ahead of ourselves.
He stood back, examining the board with the others.
It begins to take shape, he murmured, putting his cigarette out in an ashtray with a deeply satisfied stamp. Yes, Detective Sergeant, she wants the Linares child, but as John has said, she cannot have known who the Linares child was. And your own investigation demonstrates the spontaneity of the attack. Put those elements together, and what conclusion do you reach?
Lucius gave that matter just a few seconds' consideration.
That it's not who the Linares child was that mattered, it's what she was.
What she was? Mr. Moore said, confused and still not completely convinced of the usefulness of the entire exercise.
She was a baby, is what she was, and we've already said that the woman wanted one.
Miss Howard laughed. Spoken like a truly confirmed bachelor. She wasn't just a baby, John. Every baby is different. Everyone has his or her own characteristics.
She turned to the board. And so the character of the child can tell us about the character of her abductor.
Brava! The doctor fairly hollered, moving to the right-hand side of the board. Continue, Sarah. You are the one to take the lead here.
Miss Howard got up and assumed the job of pacing in front of the chalkboard.
Well, she said as the doctor stood poised with the chalk, we know that Anna was happy, cheerful by nature, noisy perhaps, but noisy in a way that charmed people.
Go on, go on,
the doctor said, scratching away. In addition, she was healthy. She'd had every advantage and seemed to embody all of them.
Yes?
And bright. At a precociously early age, she was amused by things that we consider great works of art, but which were to her intriguing in an ingenuous way. There's a sensitivity there,
Mr. Moore grumbled. You're talking about her like she's a person, for God's sake.
She is a person, John, the doctor said, still writing. Difficult as that may be for you to imagine.
Anything else, Sarah?
Only that she would have been a logical target, I'm afraid. Her gregariousness would, as I say, have attracted attention, admiring attention from most, but covetous envy from one, Marcus said, letting out a big cloud of smoke that caused his brother to cough hard.
Oh, sorry, Lucius, he said, though without much genuine concern.
Excellent, the doctor said. More than enough for a good beginning. Now then, let us turn the light of these observations onto our shadowy woman on the L. We have already determined that she did not research her victim, Rather, she experienced an apparently irresistible, spontaneous urge to immediately take this child, no matter whose she was. Any other conclusions?
She probably hasn't got any children of her own, Marcus offered.
Granted, the doctor answered, noting it. But many women don't, and they are able to restrain themselves from kidnapping.
Perhaps she can't have any children of her own, Miss Howard said.
Closer, but why not adopt one? The city abounds with unwanted children.
Maybe she can't do that either, Lucius said. A legal complication, probably a criminal record, if her behavior here is any indication.
The doctor considered it. Even better, a woman physically incapable of childbirth who is legally prevented from adopting an unwanted child because of a criminal record.
But it's deeper than that, Miss Howard murmured thoughtfully. She doesn't want an unwanted child. She's drawn to this child in particular, a child who could not be more wanted, and with good reason, given the child's healthy, vivacious character. So if we assume that all of this touches some chord... She paused.
Sarah? The doctor asked.
Miss Howard seemed to shiver a bit.
I'm sorry, but there's almost a sense of tragedy about it. Could she have had children, doctor, and lost them, say, to disease or poor health?
The doctor mulled that one over. I like it, he finally said. It's consistent with her choice of victim. Most of us, with the exception of the likes of Moore there, feel a certain longing when we see such a child as Anna Linares, however unconscious or remote. Could tragedy have been the experience that made this woman's longing irresistible? Is this to be the healthy, happy child she has always wanted?
And apparently feels entitled to, Marcus added.
What about the clothing? Lucius asked. If Senora Linares is right, and she was some kind of nurse or governess, ah... Detective Sergeant, you have read my thoughts, the doctor said. For what have we just described, if not a woman who would be drawn toward caring for children as a profession?
Oh, no, Mr. Moore said, rising and backing away. No, 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 I smell where this is going,
the doctor laughed. Indeed you do, Moore. But why should you be afraid of it? You proved during the Beecham case that you have a positive talent for such work.
I don't care, Mr. Moore answered, his horror only half theatrical. I hated every minute of it. I've never had to do such boring, miserable drudgery.
Nevertheless, it will be where the hard part of our investigation begins, the doctor answered. We will visit every nursing and governess service in this city, as well as every hospital, every foundling home, and every lying-in facility. The woman is here, with the child, and if Senora Linares's eyes are to be trusted, as I believe they are... Then she holds a position in the field somewhere.
Lucius's face had screwed up into a human question mark.
But, doctor, we don't even have a name. Just a verbal description. I mean, if we had a photograph, a picture of some kind...
The doctor set his chalk down, then slapped the white dust from his hands and vest.
And why shouldn't we?
Lucius looked even more confused.
Why shouldn't we what?
Have a picture, the doctor answered simply. After all, we have an extremely vivid description.
Picking his jacket up, he slipped it back on as he continued.
You gentlemen have missed the major feature of this case. What was the principal thing we lacked in the Beecham affair, the principal thing that is lacking in most crimes of this nature? An accurate description of the criminal. Yet we have one, and my guess is that, put to the test, Senora Linares's description will be even more detailed than it has been thus far.
But how would we translate that into a visual image? Miss Howard asked.
We would not, the doctor replied. We would and will leave that to someone trained in the field.
Pulling out his silver watch, the doctor popped it open and squinted at it.
I should prefer someone of Sergeant's ability, but he is in London and would demand an absurd fee. Akins might do too, but he is in Philadelphia. Even that is too far, given the urgency of our task. Our opponent may flee the city at any moment. We must move quickly.
Let me get this straight, Kreitzler, Mr. Moore said, ever more dumbfounded. You're going to commission a portrait of this woman, based on a description?
A sketch should be sufficient, I think, the doctor said, tucking his watch away. Portraiture is an immensely complex process, Moore. A good portrait painter must be something of a natural psychologist.
I see no reason why, given enough time with the Signora, a very reasonable likeness could not be created. The first job is to find the right artist, and I believe I know where to get a reference.
He looked my way. Stevie, shall we pay a call on the Reverend? I believe we'll find him at home and hard at work at this hour, provided he's not out on one of his nocturnal rambles.
I brightened up. Pinky? I asked, jumping out of the windowsill.
Sure thing.
Marcus looked from me to Dr. Kreisler.
Pinky? The Reverend?
A friend of mine, the doctor said. Albert Pinkham Ryder. He has many nicknames, as do most eccentrics.
Ryder?
Mr. Moore wasn't buying this idea either. Ryder's no portrait painter, and it takes him years to finish a canvas.
True, but he has a keen psychological instinct. He'll be able to recommend someone, I've no doubt. If you'd care to come along, Moore. You too, Sarah.
Very much, Miss Howard answered. His work is fascinating.
Yes, the doctor said uncertainly. You may find his rooms and studio less so, I'm afraid.
That's the truth, Mr. Moore threw in. You can count me out. That place makes my skin crawl.
The doctor shrugged.
As you wish. Detective Sergeants, I dislike asking you to perform what I feel is a useless task, but it may be worth... How did you put it?
Rousting the Cubans, Lucius answered, sounding like there weren't many things he'd like to do less.
Oh, this'll be a treat. Black beans, garlic, and dogma.
Well, at least I don't speak Spanish, so I won't know what they're saying.
I do apologize, the doctor said, but we must, as you know, cover as many possibilities as we can, and as quickly as possible.
We all began to move for the door, Marcus bringing up the rear at a slow pace.
There's just one thing, doctor, he murmured, taking deliberate steps as he turned something over in his head.
Señor Linares, what we're assuming, and I agree with the assumption completely, is that this is an abduction committed by someone who didn't know the identity of the baby.
Yes, Marcus, the doctor said.
In that case, why is Linares trying to conceal it?
The detective sergeant's face was full of concern.
The fact is that the woman we're describing, whatever her psychological peculiarities, is in all probability American. That would be just as useful to the Spanish government as a politically motivated kidnapping, so why aren't they using it?
Mr. Moore turned a somewhat smug face to the doctor.
Well, Kreisler?
The doctor looked at the floor and nodded a few times, smiling.
I might have known it would be you who would ask, Marcus.
Sorry, the detective sergeant answered, but as you say, we've got to cover all the angles.
No need to apologize, the doctor answered. I was simply hoping to avoid that question, because it's the only one I can't begin to answer. And should we find the answer, I fear we will also find some rather unpleasant and dangerous facts. But I don't think we can allow that consideration to delay our actions.
Marcus weighed this, then signaled agreement with a small nod.
It's something we ought to keep in mind, though.
As we shall, Marcus, as we shall.
The doctor allowed himself one more slow, thoughtful lap around the room, coming to a rest at the window.
Somewhere out there, even as we speak, is a woman who unwittingly holds in her arms a child who could prove an instrument of terrible destruction, as devastating in her innocence as an assassin's bullet or a madman's bomb. Yet for all of that, I fear the devastation that has already occurred in the kidnapper's mind, most of all.
Yes, we shall be alert for the dangers of the larger world, Marcus, but we must once again place our greatest efforts behind knowing the mind and the identity of our antagonist. Who is she? What created her? And above all, will the savage fury that drove her to this act eventually be turned against the child? I suspect so, and sooner rather than later.
He turned to the rest of us.
Sooner rather than later.
Chapter 10.
It's always seemed to me that there's two types of people in this life. Them what get a kick out of what might be called your odder types, and them what don't. And I suppose that I, unlike Mr. Moore, have always been in the first bunch.
You'd have to have been, I think, to have really enjoyed living in Dr. Chrysler's house, for the folks he had in and out of there, even the ones like Mr. Roosevelt, who were long on brains and went on to great fame and success, were some of the more peculiar characters you could possibly have met in those days. And of all those strange but noteworthy souls, none was stranger than the man I liked to call Pinky, Mr. Albert Pinkham Ryder. An artist by religion, in addition to profession, the tall, soft-spoken, kindly man with the big beard and searching eyes gave off the general impression of a monk or priest, which was why he was known as the Reverend or Bishop Ryder to his friends. He lived in rooms at number 308 West 15th Street, and spent most of his nights either working or on long walks around the city, its streets, its parks, even its suburbs, studying the moonlight and shadows that filled so many of his paintings. He was a solitary soul, a recluse, by his own estimation, who'd grown up in the spooky old whaling town of New Bedford, Massachusetts. He'd had a Quaker for a mother and a collection of brothers for company, all of which meant that one of his more extreme peculiarities was his way of dealing with women. Oh, he was polite enough, in a way what would have seemed chivalrous if it hadn't been so damned odd. There was the time, for instance, that he heard a beautiful singing voice floating through his building, and when he found the woman who possessed it, immediately proposed marriage to her. Now, this woman was a fine singer, sure enough, but on the street and at the local precinct house she was known to be other things, too. And it was only when a group of his friends stepped in to lower the boom on the idea that poor old Pinky was saved from what probably would have been a thorough fleecing. He liked kids. He was kind of a big, strange boy himself. And he was always happy to see me. The same could not be said for some of the doctor's other friends. By 1897, he was famous and successful enough among those who understood art to be able to live pretty much as he pleased, which was basically like a pack rat. He never threw a thing away, not a food carton or a piece of string or a pile of ashes. And his rooms really could get a little frightening at times for most people, but his gentle, quiet kindness and the definite pull of his hazy, dreamy paintings more than made up for all that, especially for me, a boy from the Lower East Side who was used to garbage piling up inside flats. That, combined with the fact that he shared my taste in food, he kept a kettle of stew always on the boil and, when out, preferred oysters, lobster, and baked beans in a waterfront restaurant, made his place a destination to which I was always happy to accompany the doctor. It was just the three of us, Miss Howard, the doctor, and myself, what made the pilgrimage that night, as Cyrus, who admired Pinky's paintings but, like Mr. Moore, didn't think much of his living habits, begged off to get a full night's sleep. Pinky's building was just west of 8th Avenue on 15th Street, and was one of thousands like it in that neighborhood, a simple old brick row house that had been converted into flats. We traveled by hansom, moving uptown with the thickening stream of traffic, what was heading for the Tenderloin at that time of night, and then branching off to find that a small kerosene lamp was burning in Pinky's front window. "Ah, so he's home," Dr. Chrysler said. He paid off the cabby, then took Miss Howard's arm. "Now, Sarah, I must prepare you. I know that you find courtly deference to your sex abominable, but in Ryder's case, you really must make an exception. It's perfectly innocent and perfectly genuine. He does not intend it as any veiled attempt to keep women fragile and weak, I assure you." Miss Howard nodded in a not completely convinced way as we climbed up the stoop of the building. "I'll give anyone the benefit of a fair trial," she said. "But if it becomes insulting..." "Fair enough," the doctor said. "Stevie, why don't you run ahead so that Ryder has some warning?" I dashed inside the building and up the dark stairs to the door of Pinky's flat, then knocked on it hard and called out to him in a loud voice. I knew that he sometimes didn't let even good friends in if he was in a fever of creation, but I felt sure he'd respond to me. "Mr. Ryder," I shouted, "it's Stevie Taggart, sir. Come with the doctor." From inside, I heard the kind of rustling that squirrels make when they get into a pile of autumn leaves, and then some heavy, slow footsteps moved toward the door. The footsteps stopped, and there was a long pause, accompanied by heavy breathing that I could hear even in the hall. Finally, a deep, rich voice, what was at once slow but a bit skittish, asked, "Stevie?" "Yes, sir," I answered. A lock was undone, and as the door was pulled away from me, a large form moved in to fill the opening. I made out the beard first, then the high, glowing forehead, and finally the eyes, the color of which, light brown or blue, I could never quite figure. I moved inside with a salute. "Hello, Pinky," I announced, marching past the piles of books, newspapers, and just plain trash in his front room toward the back of the flat where his studio and the kettle of stew were located. He smiled in his particular way, what Dr. Kreitzer always called enigmatically.
"Hello, young Stevie," he said, wiping his paint-covered hands on a rag. For all that he'd lived in New York for years, there was still much of the old-time New Englander in the way he spoke. "What brings you to these reaches at this hour?"
"The doctor's following me up," I said, moving between walls covered with unframed canvases that, to the untrained eye, would have looked like finished pictures. Beautiful golden landscapes, stormy dark seascapes, or what the art crowd called marines, as well as scenes from the poetry, drama, and myths what fascinated old Pinky. He was quite a poet himself, and, like I say, his interpretations of The Forest of Arden or The Tempest would have looked to anybody else like they were ready for shipping. But it was near impossible for Pinky to consider a painting done, ever, and he fussed and fidgeted with them, as Mr. Moore had said, for years, before he'd released them to the usually exasperated patrons what had paid for them long ago. Grabbing a wooden spoon, I helped myself to a nice scoop of Pinky's hearty lamb stew, which he'd sweetened with some fresh apples. Then I took a turn around the studio. "Quite a crop, Pinky," I called him. "How many of them are sold?"
"Enough," he answered from the front room.
Then I heard the doctor's and Miss Howard's voices and raced back out so that I could witness the ritual that Pinky went through any time a woman came to his hideaway. Making a deep bow, he said,
"I'm deeply honored, miss,"
with rumbling sincerity. Then he held out a hand.
"Please."
Next, he started to quickly clear a path through all the garbage in the room to the one easy chair he owned, a beat-up but comfortable old thing that sat by the front window. As he finished clearing the floor in front of the chair, he grabbed a small oriental throw rug and spread it out so that Miss Howard could rest her feet on it once she'd sat down, like a bohemian queen on a throne. Ordinarily, she wouldn't have been a woman to go for such treatment, but coming from Pinky, such things were just so sincere and so peculiar as to make anybody suspend their usual reactions.
"Well, Albert," the doctor said cheerfully, "you look well. A bit swollen, perhaps in spots. How's the rheumatism?"
"Always lurking about," Pinky answered with a smile. "But I have my cures. May I offer you both something to eat or to drink? Beer, water?"
"Yes, I'll have a glass of beer, Albert," the doctor answered, looking to Miss Howard. "It's a pleasant night, though not as cool as I'd expected."
"Yes, beer would be lovely," Miss Howard said.
Pinky held up a long finger, indicating he'd only be a moment, then started for the back of the flat. As he went, I noticed that his feet were making little squishing sounds. I looked down to see that he was wearing oversized shoes filled with straw and what appeared for all the world to be cooked oatmeal.
"Say, Pinky," I said, following him, "I guess you know you've got oatmeal in your shoes."
"The best thing for rheumatism," he answered, fetching a few bottles of beer and running a couple of suspicious-looking glasses under a cold tap. "My walks have become a bit painful lately. Straw and cold oatmeal, that's the answer."
He started back for the front room.
"Okay," I said with a shrug, still trailing him. "You ought to know, ain't nobody in New York walks as much as you do."
Moving with little huffing sounds, Pinky set the beer bottles and glasses down on a table made of an old wooden crate, and then started to pour.
"Here we are," he said, handing the glasses to the doctor and Miss Howard. "To you, Miss Howard," he toasted, holding his glass up. "I look upon thy youth, fair maiden. I look upon thy youth and fancy laden. Would that I a fairy were, that with magic wand I could deter all evil chance and spare thy coming years, all unwrought by rain of tears, with a rainbow bright."
"Well said, Albert," the doctor replied, holding up his glass and drinking his beer.
"Your own?" he asked, though I could tell that he knew it was. Pinky inclined his head humbly.
"Poor, but my own, and fitting for your companion."
Miss Howard seemed genuinely touched, and that was no easy trick for a member of the male sex to move her.
"Thank you, Mr. Ryder," she said, holding up her glass and taking a sip. "That was lovely."
"Say, Pinky," I tossed in, knowing that he was also a turf enthusiast, "how'd you make out in the Suburban today?"
A look of mingled disappointment and excitement came into his face.
"I'm afraid I had no time to put a bet down," he said, "but it's odd that you should mention the races, Teefy."
He lifted the same long finger again and directed us to follow him to the studio, which we did.
"A very strange coincidence indeed. You see, I've been working on something, a picture with a story behind it, you might say. Some years ago, a waiter with whom I had a passing but convivial acquaintance wagered all of his life's savings on a horse race and lost. Despairing, he then shot himself."
"How dreadful," Miss Howard said, but her shock could not hide the fact that she was becoming what you might call enchanted by the paintings that began to close in around her.
"Yes," Pinky said, "it set my mind to work. I shall not tell you precisely how, but you must see the result, as I think it may have possibilities."
He took us over to a large easel in one corner of the room, on which rested a canvas of about 2 feet by 3, covered with a light-stained piece of cloth. Pinky lit a nearby gas lamp, turned its flame up, and then stepped to the easel.
"Mind you, it's nothing like finished," he said, "but, well..."
He took the cloth away. On the easel was one of the most eerie of all his pictures that I'd ever seen. It showed a scraggly oval track surrounded by a similarly rough horse fence. On the muddy ground in front of the track was a large, nasty-looking snake. Above it, in the distance, some barren hills and a sky so gloomy that it could have been either day or night. And on the track itself, a lone rider, Death the Reaper himself, riding bareback in the wrong direction, holding his scythe high. Now, most of Pinky's pictures were mysterious, but this thing was downright grim, scary even. The doctor and Miss Howard, however, were clearly impressed, for their eyes positively glowed with fascination as they studied it.
"Albert," the doctor said slowly, "it's brilliant. Harrowing, but brilliant."
Pinky shuffled self-consciously in his oatmeal at that, and did so again when Miss Howard added,
"Extraordinary. Really. Entrancing in its way. I've decided to call it simply the racetrack," Pinky said.
I looked from the doctor and Miss Howard to Pinky and finally back to the picture. "I don't get it," I said. Pinky smiled at me and stroked his beard.
"Now that's what I like to hear. What don't you get, young Stevie?"
"What's with the snake?" I said, pointing at it.
"What does it mean to you?"
he answered. "Gotta be one fast snake to keep up with that horse." Pinky seemed to find that very satisfying. "And speaking of the horse, Pinky, he's going the wrong direction. You ought to know that."
"Yes,"
Pinky answered, looking at the picture. "And how about the sky?" I asked. "Is it supposed to be day or nighttime?"
"Do you know?"
Pinky answered, squinting those strangely colored eyes.
"I hadn't thought about it."
"Huh," I said, giving the picture the once-over again. "Oh, sorry, Pinky, but it gives me the jitters. I'll take that one up there." I pointed to a nice, richly colored job that showed a pretty young girl with strawberry blonde hair, shadowy, yes, but comforting, not gloomy.
"Ah," Pinky said, "my little maid of Acadie. Yes, I rather like her, too, and she's almost finished. You've a good eye, young Stevie."
He covered the unsettling picture on the easel back up.
"Now then, Laszlo, have you come just to check on my health, or for some other reason? I suspect the latter, as you are a man who always has reasons."
The doctor looked away a little self-consciously. "Unkind, Albert," he said with a smile. "But true. I told you, Sarah, that Albert could have been a psychologist if he'd wished." Pinky shut the gas lamp off, and we started back for the front room.
"The fact of the matter is, Albert, that we've come for a reference."
"A reference?"
"We need a portraitist," the doctor said, as Miss Howard got back onto her flea-bitten throne. "One capable of doing a portrait not from life, but from a detailed description."
Pinky looked intrigued. "An unusual request, Laszlo."
"It's my request, actually, Mr. Ryder," Miss Howard said, and very wisely, too, for while Pinky might have smelled something in the wind if the suggestion had come from a man, he'd take it as gospel coming from a woman, especially a handsome young woman. "It is, or rather was, a distant member of my family. She died rather suddenly, at sea. We've found that we have no painting, not even a photograph, to remember her by. My cousin and I, she lives in Spain, as did our dead relation, were discussing how much we wished we had some kind of an image for a keepsake, and the doctor said it might be possible to do one from memories and descriptions." She took a very fetching little sip of her beer. "Do you think it might? I have only the greatest admiration for your work, and would count your opinion as definitive." Well, sir, Pinky walked right into it. He grabbed hold of the lapels of his worn wool jacket, got most of the usual stoop out of his stance, and started to walk the floor as if his shoes were the best patent leather instead of filled with straw and oatmeal.
"I see," he said thoughtfully. "An interesting idea, Miss Howard. Your relative was a woman, you say?"
"Yes," Miss Howard answered.
"There are many excellent portraitists in New York. Ordinarily, Chase would be the first choice. Do you know him, Kreitzler?"
"William Merritt Chase," the doctor asked. "We've only met briefly, but I know his work, and you're right, Albert. He's a superb choice."
"Actually," Pinky cut in, "I don't think so. If your subject is a woman, and if you're working from memories alone, I think you ought to have a woman do the job." That brought a smile, what was in no way an act, to Miss Howard's face.
"What an excellent idea, Mr. Ryder." She glanced up pointedly at the doctor. "And how refreshing." The doctor simply rolled his eyes and turned away. "Do you happen to know one?"
"I'm often taunted by my colleagues for seeing the work of as many artists as I can," Pinky answered, "whatever their background or sex. I believe there is merit in almost any serious picture, no matter who the painter may be. Yes, I believe I know the very person for you. Her name is Cecilia Beau."
Miss Howard's head cocked a bit as if in recognition.
"Do you know of her, Miss Howard?"
Pinky said, ready to be impressed. "I seem to know the name," Miss Howard answered, wrestling with it. "Does she teach by any chance?"
"Yes, indeed, at the Pennsylvania Academy. She has a bright future there."
Miss Howard frowned. "No, that's not it."
"But she also conducts a private class," Pinky went on, "twice a week in New York. That is what made me think of her."
"Where is the class held?" the doctor asked.
"At the home of Mrs. Cady Stanton."
"Of course," Miss Howard said, brightening. "Mrs. Cady Stanton and I are old friends. I've heard her speak of Miss Beau, and in very admiring terms."
"As well she should," Pinky judged. "There is a quality in this woman's work. Well, Laszlo, I can't do better than to say that she sees through to the very essence of the personality. She has been well appreciated in Europe and will be here in time. Remarkable portraits, really, particularly those of women and children. Yes, the more I think of it, Cecilia Beau is the person for you."
"And I can reach her through Mrs. Cady Stanton," Miss Howard said, looking at the doctor. "First thing in the morning."
"Well, then," the doctor lifted his beer again, "our problem is solved. I knew we were right to come to you, Albert. You are a living compendium."
Pinky flushed and smiled, then grew more serious as the doctor said, "Now, Albert, about the racetrack, is it sold?" The two men fell to discussing the fate of the picture and drinking more beer. Pinky hadn't yet sold his unsettling work, but he insisted to the doctor that he wouldn't even consider doing so for a long time, as it was far from finished. It wouldn't be finished, by the way, until 1913. It was the same story he told about all his canvases, and the doctor displayed the same frustration what most collectors did on trying to bring Pinky into the cold world of practicalities. Finally, Dr. Kreitzler dropped the subject, and they all fell to talking of art in general, leaving me to wander into the studio again and have a little more of the delicious stew. As I ate, I looked up at the little maid of Acadie for a while longer, realizing for the first time that, in the vague sort of way what was our host's style, it was the image of Cat. We stayed at Pinky's for another hour or so, everyone having a very pleasant time amidst those piles of relics, trash, and waste. A funny kind of life, that. The old boy lived just for his pictures, and was quite happy to have that much. Give him a little good, humble food, a room to work in, and the ability to take his long walks, and he was fine. Simple, you might say. To which I'd answer, yeah, so simple that only one in a million can manage it. Chapter 11. The next morning, Miss Howard called on the telephone to say that she'd contacted Mrs. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the famous old crusader who'd been pushing women's rights for half a century. Miss Howard, it seemed, had known and admired Mrs. Cady Stanton, who always insisted on using her maiden name in addition to her husband's, ever since childhood. And as Mrs. Cady Stanton had blue-blood relatives in the Hudson Valley, not far from where the Howard family estate was, Miss Howard had been able to make her acquaintance early on through mutual friends. Miss Howard had warned the doctor that there were bound to be complications with Mrs. Cady Stanton being the agent of our meeting Miss Cecilia Bowe, as the sharp old bird was well aware of Miss Howard's personal and professional connections. She'd know full well, for instance, that Miss Howard didn't have any recently deceased relative, if Miss Howard even tried to float that lie. This left our friend with the job of trying to make her hiring of a portrait painter look thoroughly innocent. But Mrs. Cady Stanton also knew that Miss Howard was a private detective, and she instantly became fascinated by what she was sure was some kind of intrigue, so much so that she flat out asked to be present for the sketching session what Miss Howard scheduled for Thursday evening at No. 808 Broadway. Left without a graceful way to tell Mrs. Cady Stanton to mind her own business, Miss Howard was forced to agree, so it looked as if we were going to have an additional guest for the occasion. Signora Linares, meanwhile, sent a note along to Miss Howard saying that her husband was definitely getting suspicious about her absences and that this was probably the last time she'd be able to get away. Whatever we needed, we'd have to get it Thursday evening. As for the detective sergeants, their rousting of the Cubans had produced nothing except a lot of bad feeling, and they came away from the encounter convinced that nobody in the Cuban Revolutionary Party had the brains or the organizing skill to pull off anything like the kidnapping of Ana Linares. This little confirmation of his theory that the abductor was a woman acting alone sent the doctor back into a study Wednesday afternoon, and by the following morning he still hadn't emerged. His food was taken in on trays, and he left strict orders not to be disturbed. Mr. Moore and Miss Howard dropped by at around 2 on Thursday to plan strategy for the sketching session. On finding the doctor still closeted away, they asked me what was going on, to which I answered that I really didn't know, being as I hadn't seen him for 24 hours. It was time, however, to get things prepared for the evening to come, so together the three of us decided to go on up to the study and find out what was happening. Mr. Moore knocked on the door and got a sharp, "Go away, please," in return. He looked to me, but all I could do was shrug. "Kreitzler," Mr. Moore said, "what the hell's going on? You've been in there for 2 days, and it's time to get ready for the portrait." A long, exasperated groan came from inside the study, and then the door unlocked from within. The doctor, dressed in a smoking jacket and slippers, pulled it open, his face in a book. "Yes, and I could be in here for 2 years before I'd find anything really useful." He looked up at us blankly, then, with a tilt of his head, signaled that we should follow him in. The study was lined on three sides with mahogany shelves and paneling, while the doctor's large desk sat in front of the window in the fourth wall. There were piles of open books everywhere, along with journals and monographs also open. Some looked as though they'd been placed where they lay, some had clearly been thrown. "I have been attempting," the doctor announced, "to assemble some research with which we can make ourselves acquainted with the psychological peculiarities inherent in the woman-child relationship. And I have, not for the first time, been disappointed by my colleagues." Mr. Moore grinned and cleared some journals off of a sofa, then plopped down onto it. "Well, that's good news," he said. "Then we don't have to do any lessons this time around, eh?" He was referring to the Beecham case, during which the doctor had made everyone on the team read not only the basic psychological works of the day, but also articles written by specialists what had particular application to the investigation. Cyrus and I had done most of the reading, too, just to keep up. And it had been, I don't mind saying, tough going. There can't be many people in the world what can blow wind like your average psychologists and alienists. The doctor just frowned at Mr. Moore.
assuming that you have retained even a portion of what you learned last year," he said in some disgust, "then no, I don't know that there's a great deal more to be done. It's idiotic. Perfectly sound, rational men, when they reach one specific instinct, the maternal, begin to blather like idiots. Listen to the august Herr G. H. Schneider, one of James's favorites, John." Mr. Moore had been at Harvard with the doctor and had also studied, though very briefly, with Professor James. "As soon as a wife becomes a mother, her whole thought and feeling, her whole being, is altered. Until then she had only thought of her own well-being, of the satisfaction of her vanity. The whole world appeared made only for her. Everything that went on about her was only noticed so far as it had personal reference to herself. Now, however," and here a wicked kind of sarcasm came into the doctor's voice, "the center of the world is no longer herself, but her child. She does not think of her own hunger. She must first be sure that the child is fed. Now she has the greatest patience with the ugly, piping crybaby, whereas until now every discordant sound, every slightly unpleasant noise made her nervous. I ask you, Sarah, have you ever heard such utter rot?" Miss Howard's face took on a resigned sort of look.
"That is the common perception, I'm afraid."
The doctor kept ranting. "Yes, but listen to what he goes on to say. Thus, at least, it is in all unspoiled, naturally bred mothers who, alas, seem to be growing rarer. But does he go on to discuss the mental composition of those increasingly numerous unnaturally bred mothers? He does not." The doctor set the book aside. The wheels in Miss Howard's head had started to spin during this tirade, her brow wrinkled with an idea. "Doctor," she started, but he wasn't finished. Picking up another book, he bellowed, "and listen to James himself. Parental love is an instinct, stronger in woman than in man. The passionate devotion of a mother to a sick or dying child is perhaps the most simply beautiful moral spectacle that human life affords. And there ends the discussion. How would such men react, I should like to know, were I to show them the dozens of case studies I have compiled over the years of women beating their children, starving them, throwing them into lit ovens, or simply killing them outright? It's unbelievable."
"Yes, doctor," Miss Howard tried again, "but I wonder, is there some usefulness in all this prejudicial thinking?"
"Only by inference, Sarah," the doctor scoffed, tossing the book he was holding onto a pile of others and then picking up the first volume again. "Just one brief comment of Schneider's offers anything like illumination. She," meaning the mother, "has, in one word, transferred her entire egotism to the child."
"Yes, that's it exactly," Miss Howard said. "Suppose you were one of those unnaturally bred mothers, one who'd lost her own children and couldn't have any more. Wouldn't you feel the desire to somehow acquire another, if only to prove that you could adequately perform what is perceived by society to be the basic feminine function?"
The doctor's face went blank. His hands fell to his side, and then he tossed the Schneider book onto the pile with the James.
"And given the correct individual context," he said, nodding, "that urge could grow to destroy normal inhibitory power." "Well, where have you been for the last 2 days, my oracle of the feminine psyche?"
He walked over and put his hands on Sarah's shoulders.
"It's taken me God knows how many hours and pages of fruitless reading to reach that very conclusion."
The doctor walked to the door and called out into the hall, "Cyrus, draw me a bath, if you don't mind, and lay out fresh clothes." He turned to Miss Howard again.
"The last time we worked together, Sarah, we studied the known laws of psychology. This time, the biases of our society will force us to write some new ones, I suspect. You must keep careful notes, and be always on hand, for yours is the perspective we most need. The rest of us cannot—"
The doctor was interrupted by the sound of light snoring coming from the sofa. We all turned to see Mr. Moore dozing.
"Well," the doctor sighed, "let's just say that certain other points of view will be far less crucial. However, let him rest for the time being, because, with any luck, we send him out onto the streets tomorrow."
Once the doctor'd gotten himself cleaned up and dressed, we found that the only way to rouse Mr. Moore was to offer him a late lunch at Delmonico's restaurant in Madison Square. Dr. Kreisler had been spending less time than usual at that establishment because Mr. Charlie Delmonico, keeping pace with the steady uptown movement of fashion and money, had recently opened an additional restaurant on 44th Street. And though he swore to the doctor that he had no plans to close the Madison Square branch, the doctor believed that it was only a matter of time before that fate befell the place. So he'd been withholding as much as he could of his patronage. He could never have stayed away altogether, as a method of protest. Cyrus and I walked with the rest of them up to Madison Square. Though we never actually ate with the doctor in the restaurant, that just wouldn't have been possible in those days, we liked to go along, anyway, being as I'd been able to make friends with Mr. Ranhofer, the French head chef and bully boy of the kitchen, and could usually net us a couple of containers of good food what we could eat in the park. We saw the doctor and his guests to the main entrance, where Charlie Delmonico stood greeting patrons. Dr. Kreisler extended a hand, what Mr. Delmonico shook, even as the doctor announced half-seriously, "I'm still not speaking to you, Charles." Then, once they were inside, I ran around the corner to the delivery station. Winding my way through shouting men carrying crates of vegetables and fruit, as well as ice-covered wooden pallets of fish and big sides of beef and lamb, I passed through a dark hallway and soon found myself in the brick kitchen, where dozens of pots and pans hung from the vaulted ceiling. I could already hear Mr. Ranhofer's voice bouncing off the tiled walls. "No, no, no, pig! I would not feed that to an animal! Why is it so impossible for you to learn?" The object of his bellowing, I soon saw, was a young dessert chef who seemed to be taking all the insults very much to heart and looked ready to break down. Mr. Ranhofer, his huge round body wrapped in white and his big, similarly colored mustache bristling, tried to calm down a bit, then stepped over to the young man's station. "Here, come, I show you, but only once." Waiting for the exercise to be over, I glanced around at the enormous space where some 20 or 30 chefs, and assistant assistants were all working like mad and hollering at the top of their lungs, sometimes to nobody at all that I could see. Different colored flames occasionally shot up from the stoves, and the 100 different smells of the place, some tasty, some just peculiar, blended together into one unidentifiable aroma. The whole joint had the general air of some of the insane asylums I'd visited with the doctor, except that in the elegant dining rooms upstairs, people were paying top dollar for what came out of this madhouse. Eventually, I saw an opening and grabbed at Mr. Ranhofer's apron. "Say, Mr. Ranhofer!" He turned and, after a quick smile, frowned. "Please, Stiffy, go away. Not today. It is lunacy. Lunacy!" "Yeah, looks like it," I said. "What's going on?" "He'll kill me. That Charles will kill me. 3 private luncheons and then to follow a dinner for 80. How in God's name can any human manage such things?" "Ah, you'll do it," I said as reassuringly as I could. "You always do, right? That's why you're top dog in the chef pack." That got him. He smiled quickly again and called out, "France, 2 containers, the soft shell crab, now." He started wiping and wringing his hands as he surveyed all the activity in the place and then glanced down at me again. "Please, Stevie, take the food and go. This is no day for me to converse." Something caught his eye. "No, stop, do not, you imbecile, how can you possibly—" Then he disappeared in a fat flash. I took the containers of food from the man called France, who kept one eye out for his boss like he was wondering when it was going to be his turn to catch hell. On my way out, I snuck 2 forks and a like number of napkins out of a rack, then ran back through the same hallway, which was now packed even thicker with delivery men. Cyrus was sitting on a bench inside Madison Square Park, beyond a long line of hansoms that were waiting for fares on 5th Avenue. Still running, I made my way through the cabs, past the grass at the edge of the park, and then clear over the bench, handing Cyrus a container, a fork, and a napkin as I sat down on the ground beside him. We talked while we crunched on the crabs, done the way I liked them that day, just fried plain in some butter, and ate the side portions of Italian salad and rice with bananas. It was a fine meal, all the better for being free, and after I'd finished, I lay on the grass and had myself a smoke. "Cyrus," I said, looking up through the big tree boughs and branches to the sky, "how long do you figure it'll be before the doctor gives Mrs. Leshko the sack?"
"I don't know," he answered, polishing off the last of his food. "But things can't go on forever like this."
"Yeah." I waited a moment before voicing what had been on my mind since I'd seen Pinky's little maid of Acadie the night before. "Cyrus?"
"Still here."
"You figure the doctor might hire Cat? As a maid, I mean." The long pause that followed told me clearly what Cyrus thought, but he soon gave out with the words.
Cat'd have to want the work, Stevie. She's got big ideas, big plans for herself. I doubt she'd be interested.
Yeah, I guess so.
I just thought, I know, he said, trying hard to be sympathetic. You could ask the doctor, but like I say, she'd have to want the work.
I didn't pursue the topic, and after a few silent minutes we passed on to other things. But the idea had planted itself in my head, and I meant to explore it. It was past 4 by the time the doctor, Mr. Moore, and Miss Howard came out of Delmonico's, and they didn't look happy when they did. The doctor just strode quickly past Cyrus and me, saying, "We'll walk," crisply, and the rest of us fell in with him. I started purposely dragging my steps, as did Cyrus and Miss Howard, while Mr. Moore kept up with the doctor, talking to him. Neither Cyrus nor I needed to ask what had happened. Miss Howard could read the question in our faces.
"It was awful," she said. "Word of the investigation into the Institute's affairs has gotten all over. Even friends of his cut him dead. It was like we weren't even there. Thank God for Charlie, or it wouldn't have been tolerable."
We walked on down Broadway. It was a predictable reaction, I suppose, from them what likes to call themselves society, and while I knew the doctor would make like he didn't care, I also knew that, in fact, it would anger him deeply. For, as Miss Howard had said, there were some few in that society crowd what the doctor counted as his friends, and to see them retreat into rudeness with the rest, well, I was just as glad that we had time to walk to number 808 Broadway. I could only hope that Mr. Moore would be able to get the doctor refocused on our purpose by the time we got there. He actually managed that job, or at least as much of it as could reasonably be expected. When we reached the yellow brick building, we found the Isaacson brothers waiting for us, and the doctor was all business with him. As we went up and into the 6th floor, the conversation turned to how we were going to present the sketching session to our guests. Miss Howard had apparently warned Signora Linares to say nothing about what was really happening, but she went on to tell us that nothing wasn't going to be enough to satisfy the extremely curious Mrs. Katie Stanton. Miss Howard had toyed with the idea of saying that the subject of the sketch was an old friend, or even again a relation, of the Signora's, but that wouldn't explain the latter's bruises and cuts. And Miss Howard knew that Mrs. Katie Stanton would ask all about those, since husbands beating on their wives was a topic that she'd been lecturing on for decades. In fact, Miss Howard told us, Mrs. Katie Stanton had often been criticized by other women's rights leaders because she put as much emphasis on trying to change the conditions that caused violence in the home, drunkenness and the like, and on making it easier for women to get out of bad situations by loosening up divorce laws, as she did on securing the vote for her sex. I'm bound to say that I saw her point. Most of the women in my old neighborhood couldn't have cared an owl's hoot about who was president. They were too busy trying to survive the rampages of their husbands. Anyway, Miss Howard and Mr. Moore were still playing with ideas as to just what lie they were going to present Mrs. Katie Stanton with when the doctor said that they should just drop the subterfuge and tell the old girl the truth. Or rather, most of the truth. There was no reason to say who Señora Linares was exactly, and no reason to mention her daughter. We could just explain that she'd been attacked by another woman in Central Park and robbed. If Mrs. Katie Stanton wanted to make more out of it, let her try. Miss Howard didn't much like that idea and only gave in when an electrical buzzing device, what was connected to a button in the lobby of the building, let us know that Señora Linares had arrived. As she went down to retrieve our first guest, it remained obvious that Miss Howard figured make more out of it was just what Mrs. Katie Stanton was likely to do. The Signora was in a bit of a state when she first got out of the elevator, convinced that she'd been followed, either by her husband or somebody else. Cyrus was sent down to scout the area, but couldn't spot anyone who seemed to be keeping an eye on number 808. This offered the Signora some consolation, but not much, and it was all she could do to focus on the instructions the doctor gave her about what she was and was not supposed to say in front of the other women. The sound of the buzzer going off again sent her back into a bit of a panic, but Mr. Moore stayed with her and got her calmed down, while Miss Howard went to fetch the promising painter and the living legend. Chapter 12. None of us really knew what to expect when we heard the elevator rumble back up. I guess I figured some sour old battle axe smelling of mothballs was going to come barreling in like one of the Furies. I was pretty surprised then, and so, from the looks on their faces, was everyone else, when a very respectably but fashionably dressed lady walked gracefully through the front door, her hair carefully done up in tight curls, and the delicate lace around her neck and chest decorated by a large, pretty cameo. For a minute, I thought she must be the painter. Based on what I'd seen of women reformers, they didn't go much for frills and jewelry. But then I saw that the hair was snow-white, and the skin was sagging and wrinkled, and I knew that she was too old to be the artistic comer Pinky had talked about. The eyes, though, had a youthful, alert look about them which clued me into the fact that, while this might be somebody's grandmother, it wasn't anybody you wanted to treat as such. She carried a brass-handled stick, but held herself proud and upright like the renowned veteran she was, Mrs. Elizabeth Cady Stanton. The only woman who'd had the nerve to go so far as to rewrite the Bible from the woman's point of view. Behind her came a younger lady who might have been Miss Howard's older sister, so similar were their looks, dress, and demeanor. Miss Cecilia Beau had features what were handsome rather than beautiful, and what centered on a positively mesmerizing pair of light eyes. She wore a plain button-down blouse with a little ribbon around the neck, as well as a light linen tunic and a simple skirt to match. The common ground between her and Miss Howard seemed to be more than just superficial, too, for they were already chatting away like old friends. Miss Howard telling Miss Beau about our trip to Pinky's, and Miss Beau talking of a similar trip she'd made. In addition, I later learned that the pair shared like backgrounds. Both coming from wealthy families, Miss Howard's, as I've said, in the Hudson Valley, Miss Beau's in Philadelphia, that thoroughly disapproved of the young lady's unusual styles of living. Introductions were made all around, after which I withdrew quickly into my windowsill and didn't say a word. You could see in Mrs. Cady Stanton's face, as she looked from person to person, that she was trying to size the situation up but not getting very far. As Miss Beau took out her sketching materials and drew up a chair next to the Senora, Miss Howard gave out with the fabricated, or as the doctor might have preferred to call it, incomplete explanation of what we were about and why we'd engaged Miss Beau's services. Mrs. Cady Stanton's eyes grew narrow at Miss Howard's words, but when she spoke, her voice was pleasant enough. "You say it was another woman, Sarah? That's unusual. And the motive was money?" Mr. Moore cut in, trying to blunt the questions with charm. "In New York, Mrs. Cady Stanton, the motive is generally money, and there's very little in this city that can be accurately called unusual, I'm afraid." In a snap, Mrs. Cady Stanton's expression became much cooler, and she turned a stern eye on Mr. Moore. "Indeed, Mr. Moore, is it? Well, I've lived many years in New York, on and off, Mr. Moore, and not always in the best of neighborhoods, and I think I can safely say that an attack by one woman on another in Central Park in broad daylight is not a common occurrence. Perhaps one of these policemen will confirm that." She tossed her head in the direction of the Isaacsons, who, while at a loss as how to handle her, were clearly annoyed at being so labeled. "Oh," Lucius said, taking out his handkerchief to wipe his forehead, "I couldn't, that is, not common," Marcus finally said, as confidently as I imagine anyone could have in that situation. "But not unheard of, ma'am." "Indeed." Mrs. Cady Stanton didn't care for that answer. "I'd like someone to give me some examples." While this little exchange was going on, Miss Howard had moved into one corner of the room with Miss Beau and Senora Linares, and the Senora had begun the actual work of telling the artist what her attacker had looked like. Seeing that the discussion was likely to keep Mrs. Cady Stanton out of this important business, the doctor stepped in. "If you have a day or two, Mrs. Cady Stanton, I should be happy to list any number of cases involving violent attacks committed by women." Mrs. Cady Stanton turned on him. "By women? Against other women?" she said disbelievingly. "Against other women," the doctor said, with a smile that warned he was in earnest. "Daughters against mothers, sisters against sisters, rivals for affection against one another, and, of course, mothers against daughters." He pulled out his cigarette case. "Do you mind if I smoke? And would you care to?"
No, thank you, but you go ahead.
Studying the doctor for another minute, Mrs. Cady Stanton raised a finger to point at him as he lit his stick.
I know about you, Doctor. I've read some of your work. You specialize in criminal and children's psychology.
True, the doctor answered.
But not in feminine psychology, Mrs. Cady Stanton said. Tell me, Doctor, why is it that no scientists of the mind make women their field of specialization?
It's odd that you should ask, the doctor answered. I've recently been wondering about that very question.
Well, let me answer it for you.
Shifting in her chair so that she fully faced him, Mrs. Cady Stanton started to out-and-out lecture the doctor.
Psychologists do not study